Hey folks, just a quick note about the audio quality of this particular podcast. This Sunday that we recorded this, we gathered as a community at our family home in our screen porch in the backyard. It was a beautiful summer Sunday. And so all the noises that go with gathering in a relatively outdoor space are part of this. You can hear the screen door slamming and you can hear the background noises. Particularly noteworthy are the ways in which the little people in our community make their presence known audibly on this podcast, which is delightful, but can also make it hard to hear, you know, what the talker is saying. So that's all part of this. I hope that you can, you know, just turn it up and imagine yourself in a screened porch surrounded by the forest and exploring big ideas of faith and belief and spirituality together with a group of people that you enjoy and trust. Thanks for listening. Peace.
Well, for everybody that wasn't here last week, or just kind of for a benefit of all of us, because we're all thinking about lots of things at the same time, just a little recap about kind of how we've been approaching this. Because we're sort of talking about prayer, but prayer has sort of also been the window into talking about some of the things that are problematic about the idea of God as interventionist, period, which really intersects directly with prayer, right? I mean, how we pray just has everything to do with how we imagine God operates in the world. And so, but just to recap briefly, the notion of God as interventionist basically means the idea that God is the sort of being that would fiddle with human affairs. So last week, to just sum it up really succinctly, I try to describe the reason we often pray, not always, but often, which is to ask God to just basically do that, to mess with the nature of the world around us on our behalf. Please fix this. Please help this to happen instead of that. Like, those are all interventionist requests, right? And I didn't use those exact terms, but that pretty much sums up the perspective I was coming from. We often pray to get the divine on our side. When we do that with the basic assumption that God actually functions that way, as an interventionist being that messes with the outcome of things in a way that affects the lives of human beings, right? That's often what's going on in the background. And so we talked last week a little bit about what's problematic about that, and as I tried to engage with it, basically what I said was that in order to believe that God intervenes, we have to accept the notion that God is not only capable of controlling or altering human affairs, why ask if that's not the working assumption, but also that God is inclined to do that. In other words, given all the horrible things that happen, we have to accept the notion that God not only chooses to intervene, but to not intervene, sometimes on a grand scale. Any other sort of framework for intervention is delusional. Because it's not a full circle. God only intervenes for me. And all those other things, I don't know, but they're not this. Like, it's just completely illogical. So if you take one, you have to have the other. And we considered how that can foster a view of God that's based in fear, and touched on what the writer of 1 John says, which essentially is that fear is the opposite of love. And the rationale in that text is that is because fear involves punishment, to use the NIV actual words from the text. So that idea that God intervenes but doesn't intervene is just redolent with distress and fear. And the writer of 1 John says that feeling is the opposite of love. And if we're having that experience, it's because we're not mature in love yet. That's sort of how that text comes at it, which is interesting. And then we spent a little bit of time reflecting on a story from the Gospel of Luke in which Jesus rather pointedly says that evil governors don't kill people because God is angry, and buildings don't fall down on people because God is punishing them. It's because shit happens. Because, as the writer of Matthew says, it does rain on the just and on the unjust. And that's sort of Jesus' explanation. And then we left off with some personal questions along the lines of, how do I explain it to myself or to others when terrible things happen? How do I explain it when good things happen? Do I use the same explanation for myself that I use for others? And that was sort of the, let's go muse on this. And see where we go. So where I want to pick up this morning is with the culture into which Jesus would have told those stories about evil rulers and falling towers and why bad things happen. And whenever we talk, just by way of a little bit of background framework, so you know how I'm thinking about this, whenever we talk about ancient cultures and what they believed, how they lived, all that, we're doing some serious speculating. But we're not just speculating. And so I think that's an important kind of tension. Anytime we're working with what we Westerners call history, the word itself contains the word story, and that's a really important clue about what we mean. We're talking about periods in history where we have something written down about them. Everything before where we started finding things written down, we call prehistory, which is kind of bizarre. Like it didn't happen. Which basically says a really important thing about how much stock we place in language, and particularly in what's written down. It's super fascinating for another day, but it's super fascinating to me to be living in an age in which things that are written down are becoming categorically untrustworthy. Short description of the internet, right? Like, we are living in an age where that whole Western idea that history written down is something you can reference in a meaningful, trustworthy way is just falling apart all around us. So the next thing is going to be really intriguing. How do you decide what you're going to trust? Another dose. Anyway, in any case, when it comes to the culture of Jesus' time, well, you end up in this. The short version is you end up just trusting yourself, right? And everything else is referential, but that's a problem too. So anyway, like I said, another time. Yeah, that's right. So when we talk about the culture of Jesus' time, we've got quite a bit written down, not just the biblical record. There's lots and lots of extra-biblical information. So when we try to get our heads around why did that happen or what did people believe to help us sort of understand what we're looking at from our 21st century Western vantage point, we've got a sort of informed approach to things like ancient stories because we have quite a bit of background material to work with. So when I say that Jesus lived in a culture that was deeply superstitious, I don't feel like I'm just offering I just made this up opinion. Like there's ways to ground that opinion. And if we start with the biblical record, it's full of stories that are asked, people that are asking well-meaning questions about difficult things in ways that reveal the perspective from which they were asking those questions. So the text itself, the stories themselves, give us clues about the perspective of the question askers. So, for example, a group of people come to Jesus at one point and say, why was this man born blind? Was that because of his sin or his parents' sin? They're just revealing their understanding of how the world works. If something bad happens, it's because you did something bad. So why does something bad happen when you do something bad? Because there's a greater force than you that is causing something bad to happen, that sees whether you did good or bad. So there you go. There's their cosmology. There's their life, the universe, and everything, like inside a question. Why is this person blind? Because they did something bad? Because their parents did something bad? So now we also know that their understanding is that generational moral or ethical errors have these long consequences, that God kind of tracks this stuff, right? It's fascinating. Or the working assumption from that story we looked at last week from Luke, which was that the Roman authority Pilate slaughtered some Galilean religious pilgrims because of some religious or moral code that they'd violated. That's the way the people who asked Jesus the question framed the question. We're not speculating about that. That's the way Luke delivered the story, which doesn't mean he's quoting people. It means he's revealing the perspective that he knows as a storyteller. So in other words, God in that story in Luke, from the perspective of the people that are asking the question, is basically someone who turns Pilate into a deadly agent on behalf of the divine. So Pilate is actually working out God's justice. Like, do you see how many things got fiddled with in that little string? Right? So you break the code, God sees, God punishes when you do that, but God's not going to necessarily show up and like smite you with an angel with a flaming sword or something sort of more directly cosmic. He's got Pilate. So he just, pokes Pilate and pisses him off when he gets out of bed in the morning. So when the Galileans make things a little too rough out there, he just calls the troops. But God's behind all that in that perspective. So that stuff's just right there in the story. So just a couple more things about that Pilate story, because there's so many disconnects, and learning how to read this stuff I think is important. So Pilate isn't a Galilean. He's a Roman. He doesn't even belong to the Jewish people. He doesn't accede to or acknowledge the moral or religious code under which they live. God's laws, as the Hebrews understood them, mean nothing to Pilate. He could have cared less about all of that. What he cares about is whether the way the people, the Galileans, the Hebrews, the Jews, are acting out their religion, whether that makes the crowd restful or restless. The Romans let conquered peoples keep their religions because it tended to keep them settled down. That's what he cares about. He doesn't care about the law. So, to put it really bluntly, if you want to take like the Jesus story, which is basically the same story as the Galilean pilgrims, but with an individual instead of a crowd, in terms of Pilate's actions, Jesus didn't die on a cross because God was pissed. Jesus died on a cross because the Jews were pissed and Pilate was nervous. And he had the power. He settled it down. Right? How do I calm this crowd down? I give them what they want. What do they want? They want this guy dead. All done. Like, we don't even have to drag the divine into that story to understand it. Right? So it's just kind of fascinating that all this stuff, and same thing with the Galilean pilgrims. According to Jesus, they didn't die because they did something wrong. They died because they lived in a world that included a nervous Roman political leader who had a lot of power at his beck and call, and whose job description it was to maintain the Roman version of peace. They were messing with that. The way the Romans kept the peace was they killed the people that are messing with peace. Anyway, a conundrum of its own. But here's some information that's running in the background of all that superstition that I think might help us get a better grip on why we still, at least in or around the Christian religion, might find ourselves thinking or praying in ways that are essentially superstitious. So, this news flash, not to this room maybe, but to lots of people, it seems like that Jesus was not a blow-dried, like, blue-eyed Anglo-Saxon. Like, he just wasn't. There's a lot of art to the contrary, but if we look at most of our European icons, they look surprisingly European. If you look at African icons, they look surprisingly African, and so on and so forth, which is a fascinating thing in itself. But our assumptions about who Jesus was tell us a lot about how we're going to think about his life and his teachings and all that stuff. So Jesus was a Jew, not a Christian. Jesus didn't come to start Christianity. He was a faithful Jew. He was someone who came from, who was raised in the culture of the Jews as it existed 2,000 years ago. And that means, among other things, that the systems of belief that Jesus and those who wrote about Jesus are surrounded by are the ones that are part and parcel of the Jewish religion, of the Hebrew tribe, of Hebrew history, and of Hebrew religious practices. That was Jesus' system of belief. Now, he pushed on it really, really hard. That's one of the reasons why he died so young. But that was still the system in which he operated and in which the people who were listening to him operated. So, one of those traditions that I think has a lot to say to us about understanding sort of how people of that time and of that religion understood the way God operates in the world was this whole idea about what we've translated the word in our English text as scapegoating. The word itself, the Hebrew word that we translate as scapegoating in the Bible, is actually this really complex, multi-part word. The way it ended up being the word scapegoat in most of our English translations is that William Tyndale, who was doing a complete translation of the Bible in 1530, chose that word to represent that complex Hebrew idea. And he actually wrote it like he wrote it with the E in brackets, so it's the S-scapegoat. So he bracketed the E, and we've turned it into the English word scapegoat. So that's sort of the history of the word. Words carry ideas, so that's why I spend so much time on them, right? We can just assume we know the idea. But if we backtrack into that word, one of the things we discover is that the Hebrew word from which we get scapegoat can also be translated without any kind of gymnastics into the name of a demon. It's really interesting. So we've kind of got this mashup of understandings, but they end up focused on a ritual that is designed to help the people believe that they could escape the wrath of an angry God because their notion of the divine has this rather prominent feature in it of fear of being punished if they broke the religious rules, the law. That's kind of like this hallmark of that whole system. And I think it's also worth noting that for those people, both the ancient Hebrews and the Jews of Jesus' time, things were hard. Like, they lived in a really difficult situation. So they're the little guys as a tribe. The Hebrew people, despite the numbers in the Exodus story, which are, there's just absolutely no evidence that those numbers mean anything except everybody left. They're not big group of people. There's no evidence whatsoever of a large group of people traveling through any of those regions, any point in history, where the text says that they did. Little groups, yes. No big groups. So the Hebrews were not a big tribe. And so they keep getting run over by, like, the Assyrians and the Sumerians and then eventually the Romans, right, who just kind of steamroll everybody. So they live most of their history oppressed. We can't even imagine that. Like, on our worst day, our version of oppression kind of doesn't reach very far toward what this people group experienced. I'm not saying it doesn't matter, just that there's a lot of weight in history there. And that these, so that's where they live. And so a belief system, if you are a group of people who are constantly being displaced and enslaved and oppressed and terrorized, you're living in this super dangerous, super uncertain world. And so a belief system that says if something bad happens, somebody needs to be blamed is super logical. And usually, there's somebody to blame. It's usually the neighboring tribe that has a bigger army. Like this, but why did they attack us? Why us? Why us over and over again? We still need an answer to the question. Oh, wait, maybe there's something bigger going on. Well, who's bigger than the Assyrians? That would basically be God. Right? Like, where do you go when you're trying to explain this? So, that they would come up with a system that says when something bad happens, somebody needs to be blamed, totally makes sense. It's not a thing to disdain at all. We do the same thing. Right? And from our vantage point in the 21st century, we would defer to the soft sciences. Basically, psychology says that our psyche needs an explanation for things that happen. We do not like it if we can't answer that question. Why did that happen? It makes us incredibly restless on a good day. It makes us ill on a more extreme day. It causes us to die by our own hand or otherwise if it gets too intense. We just hate it. The Hebrew people needed to blame someone. And so they did. They blamed the victims, like the Galilean story. It must be their fault that the tower fell down. Somebody's got to be to blame. Or they blamed their families, this guy or his parents. Somebody has to be to blame. Or they blamed a demon or an evil spirit. They created scapegoats. And we still do this. Now, that whole scapegoat system, the short version of that ritual, is that as the Hebrews had practiced it, and this is kind of, I take the time for this because I think it kind of shines a little light in on some of the ideas. There were two goats in this ritual. One was the goat that was killed because God demanded blood. So their understanding of the divine is that in order to appease the divine, because everybody knows we break the rules, we all know we don't keep them all the time. So this is just a fact. So how are we going to respond to that? If God's mad or inclined to act that way, If God gets pissed off enough, so we got to get something in between there, or we're done for, right? Like the Assyrians are right on the border, and if God pokes them the way God pokes Pilate, boom. So something needs to get in the middle, and that would be blood, because these are the way the systems worked all around them. So one of the goats gets killed, and the blood from that goat gets carried ritually into the place of worship, whether that's the tent when they're moving or the temple when they build it or whatever, right? The other goat gets the sins of the people ritually placed on its head, and then it either gets chased out into the desert to die or carried out there and left to die. So it's a symbolic scapegoat for the people. It's how they get away with it, how the whole thing doesn't collapse on them. The goat's in the middle, and it's carrying away the thing that would cause the whole thing to fall in on them. It's their explanation, their way out. So we still do this, right? And this is fascinating to me. I mean, in the 21st century, North America, I could name people that I know personally who are being treated for medically treatable mental illness, whose families are still telling them that the reason that they have that experience is because of a demon. We like our explanations. We don't let go of them easily. If you want to study this in a non-religious setting, read the history of medicine. And just on one question, just read the part of the history of medicine that answers the question, how long did it take for people to start to believe that washing your hands in a hospital would reduce deaths? Like, just check that one out. How long that took. Because Galen, who wrote the original manual that said nothing about germs, was the guy. And that's what they believed. And he said nothing about that. So when people started talking about that, it took like hundreds and hundreds of years for doctors to go, about something we now go, well, duh, about. So this is just our human thing. This is just how we operate, right? So we still do this. We still create scapegoats. And it might not be that one. Like, we might not kind of go straight to the it's a demon thing. We might kind of, in fact, we listen to a story like that, we might even kind of go, I wouldn't do that. Like, I don't think that way. I don't believe that. I'm more enlightened than that about mental health, something along those lines. But what about the way that we explain the problems of our wider society? Like, it's not hard to see that we make scapegoats in the wider discourse, and that the scapegoats tend to be whoever's not like us. So it's somebody from another culture, it's somebody from another religion, it's somebody that lives somewhere else, it's somebody that doesn't speak my language or practice my customs or dress like me or have my skin color or come from my socioeconomic status or somebody who worships in a mosque or whatever. Who do we blame for the lack of affordable housing? Who do we blame when unemployment rises instead of falls? Who do we blame when there's an increase in unemployment, there's an increase in crime, we encounter overcrowding, we come to the healthcare infrastructure and it's insufficient? Like, we go looking. And usually there's some kind of othering that's part of that process. It's somebody other. than us in some significant way. And that's just human. I think it's sure handy to blame somebody that isn't like me. And one word for that is scapegoating. It's like that's what we're doing. Consciously or otherwise, we're all prone to it. And I think it might be reasonable to say that people who are different from me are the demons of, you know, my enlightened times. Like I'm still doing it. let's just say, for the sake of moving on, that I've managed to make a reasonable case saying that scapegoating is a logical way to explain bad things when they happen, but it can also be seen to have some problems, the central one being that it depends on unfounded beliefs or superstitions. If we start there, I still think that leaves us with this question. So, if scapegoating has those weaknesses, which in my mind are enough to make me go, there, that's a bad idea, that's a bad way to explain things, then what? Because the drive to explain them has not gone away. Just because I looked at the system that I might default to and go, that's not a good system. I still want an explanation. I still want a way to enter into this. So how might we understand or explain it when bad things happen? Especially the sorts of things that we would like to be saved from or that we might consider asking God to mess with on our behalf. Or on behalf of someone we love. Well, what are the options? We could consider cause and effect as part of this wrestling. There are some patterns of behavior that might have devastating consequences. So, for example, if we ingest too much of some things, even good things, potentially, into our bodies, we measurably increase some well-known health risks. So, let me pick a not good thing. We don't become ill and die from a lifetime of heavy smoking because we're bad people or because God is angry. We do that because we spend our life sucking carcinogens into our lungs. Great, so we can go, there's the cause and effect explanation for why bad things sometimes happen. But that doesn't cut it in an explains everything kind of manner, because we all know people that have abused their bodies and lived to 102, and other people who only ate superfoods and went for a run every morning who fell over at 32. So that's not going to cut it. It seems like shit is still mercilessly random. Right? Which, in my mind, leads, I'm going to skip some other options in between, but it leads to a question about free will. And this is an explanation for why bad things happen that has had some real appeal for me over the years. I have gone to this explanation more than once. I find it starting to lose its grip on me, at least. But a classic response to the question of why do bad things happen if God is omnipotent is that God has had to surrender a certain amount of divine power to allow us the freedom to exercise our free will. And that's kind of logical, right? Like, for us to be actors in the world, for that to be a meaningful idea, we need to actually be free to choose what we do, including choosing things that might be hurtful or just downright evil. We need that freedom if we're going to meaningfully act. Despite the obvious appeal of that explanation, and I really like, it appeals to me. It really does. Because I really value the freedom to choose and to act. It still leaves an enormous problem, which is that if God is all-powerful, then God is still responsible for anything that happens. Whether God causes it or whether God makes room for it, the buck still stops at the divine under this explanation. So God still isn't off the hook with this idea that free will is an explanation for why bad things happen. And that, because still, in that system, it still means that I'm asking God to intervene in my little world, which means that I still have a divine being that is helping me while failing to respond to the cries of hundreds of thousands of innocent people in the world. That's still true, even if I've got freedom. So, just how should I feel about a God that would relieve suffering somewhere and elsewhere choose not to? And in any case, the free will argument can only account for some of the causes of suffering because it leaves completely unaddressed issues like natural disaster or suffering that's caused by animals or nature, including things that are like Stephen Fry cited this instance in a television show one time when someone asked him, what would you say to God if you met him? And he basically said, I'd ask him, he's not very charitable in his description, but what kind of a being would create an insect that burrows into the eye of a child and causes blindness? Because that insect is there. It exists. I would just want to say, like, what kind of being would do that? So there's the problem, right? So it's still pretty intact. So here's a question. Why would we, if we do, why would we tie ourselves into knots trying to defend the idea that God is all-powerful? Why would we do that? Why would we torture ourselves with questions like, what does God want to teach me through this circumstance, or how is this part of a larger divine plan? Why are we so insistent about that perspective? And I think there's a way to consider that. There's actually a way to engage with that and not just go, well, just because God's all powerful. Like, which is not an explanation, by the way. Like, it just isn't. So, the idea that God is all powerful, and it's a very common, I mean, it's a cornerstone in Christian theology, right? But it actually comes from somewhere in human history. It did not arrive at the beginning of what we understand to be time, never mind history, because the beginning of history, remember, is nothing like the beginning of time. All right, so it did not arrive that way. It comes from an actual discernible part of history. And where it comes from is from this imagery of the ancient monarchy, which, by the way, is the system of governance under which almost all of Christendom's sacred text is written and all of the Hebrew people's sacred text. So once you get out of tribal life, which happens really early on in the text with Abram and that whole story, which also has a patriarch, who has an enormous power, is you go to monarchy. You go to a king. Really early in the story. And some of you have read the story and you remember that the Hebrew people were like, give us a king! And the prophets were like, are you sure? Because kings can be really nasty guys. And if you got a king, they're gonna have the power. And they were like, yeah, everybody else has a king and they keep running over us. So we need a king. And so they get a king, right? And that's the David story, like in a really short version. So this has it's just visible in the history from which the stories come and the storytellers live. That's important because an ancient monarchy is all-powerful. That's the way the people experience it. In an ancient monarchy, the king's will is absolute. The king's purpose is absolute. If you violate the king's will or purpose, you are in danger of experiencing the king's wrath. That's the way an ancient monarchy works. That's why the prophets said, are you sure? Because that's how that system operates. Operated that way all around them. And then when they got that system, guess what? Like, that's how it operated for them as well, which is why you have all the books of the prophets. Good king, bad king, bad king, bad king, bad king, good king, bad king, bad king, bad king, bad king, good king. Like, there's, I don't know, three good kings in that whole string of Bible stories. That's kind of how it worked, right? So that's how the people experienced it. That's how they understood that idea. Now, in the modern world, the world in which we live, there might still be a few despots who have a lot of power and who exercise it violently, and we're aware of some, maybe even most of those. But nobody, I don't think, well, maybe I shouldn't say nobody, that's just too absolutist. Almost nobody would affirm that as a good model for governance. I don't know anybody that wants that I know. But that's the main image of God in the Hebrew Scriptures. That's how God governs in the Hebrew Scriptures. Because, and that totally makes sense. It's not the Hebrews failing. They're doing exactly what we do. They are writing an answer to the question, why do these things happen, working with the things that they have to work with. They're just doing the logical sort of human thing. Now, what happens in the New Testament part of the Bible is that that idea of monarchy gets modified by the idea of divine parenthood. The idea of God as a parent is almost invisible in the Hebrew Scriptures. It barely, it's like a blip, and it's just gone. It's buried in monarchy again. Kind of does this little, if you're really looking for it, you can see the niggles, but there's no insistence about it. There's no framework for it. But in the New Testament, the idea of God as a monarch gets modified by the idea of God as a parent. Now, at that point in history, the cultural setting is patriarchy, which I feel like don't get me started on patriarchy right now because I'm two-thirds of the way through the best book I've ever read on it, and my mind is being blown. And if I get started, I won't stop because I'm just reconsidering my whole world around this issue right at the moment. But what happens, it's a patriarchal culture, so we have the idea of parenthood that comes into this imaging of the divine in that part of history, but it's still a patriarch because that's the cultural framework. So that kind of is the filter that colors everything about how we understand the divine in the New Testament. The divine is a patriarch, but a parent, not a monarch. But what happens if we take that idea of God as a parent and we keep evolving it and we move it into a more modern understanding of parenting? And I get that a modern understanding of parenting is a moving target. And so before anybody freaks out and says, you can't do that, let me just remind you that I've spent a whole bunch of your collective time already this morning saying that's what the biblical writers were doing. Like, this is what we do with stories. We make them of the things that we have, right? So what happens if we take the thing that we have that's about parenthood and we think, what if we imagine the divine that way? Because that's what the people who are trying to figure out what Jesus' teaching was about were doing. The object I think we would probably have general consensus that the object of any right-minded parent is not to control the lives of their children, but to support them and empower them to make their own wise and responsible choices in life. I want my kids, I can speak for myself with confidence here, I want my kids to become decent, mature adults who can deal effectively with what life throws at them, and I am quite confident that that is going to include some inexplicable suffering. And I already know, because my kids are older, I already know that whatever influence I have is limited. And I know that my kids are going to eventually decide for themselves what they will do and who they will become. I had the privilege on Friday night of sitting with a group of another family friends. All of our kids are about the same age and they've kind of grown up together. It's this really cool friendship group. And so the whole bunch of them are young adults now. Some of them are done university. Some of them are just about done university. But they're kind of that university age, right? So they're just getting inundated with new ideas. And they're pretty much new idea people, most of them. They're pretty thinker kind of bunch. And we started talking about marriage. What a great conversation. You want to sit with a group of people who are going, how do we reinvent this institution? Because the previous iteration no longer works in the culture. It was fantastic. So I'm sitting across the table from my kids, and I'm listening to them reinvent an institution that still anchors my life. Woo! Right? It was super exciting. It was really disconcerting, but it was so cool. And kind of going, if I was them now, like, Karina and I kind of looking at one another and going, if we did this over now, like under these circumstances, given some of these arguments, some of these observations, what would we do with this institution? Like, it wouldn't look like it looks, I'm pretty sure. Does that mean it's bad? No. Did we want to get married? Yeah. Am I sorry I did? Not most days. Right? And that's not about marriage in any case. That's about, you know, the humans who made up this marriage. So, but how would I rethink this thing? So when we're doing that work, the thing to remember, fear is the opposite of love. The thing to remember is we don't need to be afraid to do it. It's what, if we take sacred text as having some authority in our lives, it's what's happening throughout that text. And it just flows out the other end. It just keeps happening. It's not a closed text. Our ideas about the divine are not closed. Because somebody said, you know, there's going to be a bunch of horses and they're going to be bridle deep in blood the end. I just was summarizing Revelation. So, right? Like, this is not a closed text. I said to somebody the other day, I think we were just like yards away from the Isle of Patmos when we were in Greece. And I'm like, I think John was just there alone too long. Like, I think that explains Revelation. Not really. But anyway, pretty trippy. All to say, as a parent, when I think about 21st century parenthood, I know the influence that I have is limited. So what I want to do is not control the outcomes for my kids. What I want to do is empower them to move toward good outcomes, whatever life brings them. Because in the end, parenthood isn't about power, it's about love. So by way of giving us something other than that sort of ancient picture of omnipotence, all-powerful, to consider, which is all about power. Omnipotent means all-powerful. It does not mean all-powerful and loving. It just means all-powerful. And that's the question we're wrestling with here. So instead of that picture for the divine, I'm going to give us some other characteristics, possible characteristics for imagining God as alternatives. Just things to imagine. Just things to make our imagination go, if I imagine God that way and working that way in the world, how would that change the way I address myself to the conundrums of suffering, for instance, whether it's in my life or elsewhere. So just... it's all these are just little idea pokes. What happens in my imagination if I let go of the idea of God as omnipotent? Have we given enough background for that we don't have to stop there? What happens if I let go of the idea of God as omnipotent and instead I try to imagine God as... now, this is important because I'm not talking about just the practice of God. I'm talking about the nature of the being of God. So by the way, all of these are still predicated on the idea of God as a being, which you've already heard me say I don't think is a given. But we're going to work in that frame because the next step is like, for a lot of us. So, what if I let go of the idea of God as omnipotent and instead I try to imagine God as love and justice? So, this is the distinction. I'm not imagining an all-powerful being that practices love and justice. I am displacing the idea of God as all-powerful with the idea that God is love and justice. God is power. God is love and justice. Not God is power, and by the way, God does things that are loving and just. This idea, that idea. Same plane. God is all-powerful. God is love and justice. What happens if I imagine the divine that way? What happens if I imagine... What happens if I imagine that God refuses to control and coerce, even if that were possible, which I also don't believe is a given, personally? But what if I believe that the divine refuses to control or coerce, will not go there? What if God's mission is to strengthen and inspire us to become all that we can be as human beings? What if that's God's core mission? How does that change the way I imagine the way God operates in the world? What if, instead of magically intervening in some circumstances but not others, God suffers with the suffering? What if, instead of magically intervening in some circumstances but not others, God empowers us to be strong and creative and courageous in addressing ourselves to evil and tragedy wherever we encounter it, with goodness and compassion? What if that's God's mission? What if our creative imagination is the same thing that we might have been taught to call the Holy Spirit, the presence of God in us? Not a new idea to me by a long shot. The Quakers have been talking about this forever. What if we think about our creative imagination as the same thing that we've been taught to call the Holy Spirit, which is just a phrase that means God's alive in us? What if whatever inspires us toward a life and a world in which love and justice prevail over hatred and oppression are the exact sorts of things that we should use God language for, and the patriarchs, and arguably men in general, historically speaking? But when love acts, what are the outcomes? If love was acting and you saw violence, would that not seem as profoundly incongruent as anything you can imagine? When we do see it, when someone says, I love you, but they beat you, does that not strike us as incongruent in the extreme? See what I'm saying? So we can take a huge idea like omnipotence and not be afraid to mess with it, because all those other potentials are there. That we would say, instead of regarding God as omnipotent, we would regard God as love and God as justice. And all of a sudden, the funnel, for me anyway, goes from this idea about power and how it behaves in the world to this idea about love and how it behaves in the world. And that just has endless good possibilities. Unlike power, which has limited good possibilities. It's not that there are none. I don't know. To me, that's super intriguing. And we're just going to leave it with this, and we'll pick it up here the next time I do a talky bit, which may or may not be next week, depending where we are, depending if I'm in Saskatoon. I don't know. There's lots of... depends. But what if? What if we could actually see a practical, embodied enactment of some of those possibilities in a human life? And in particular, as a follower of the way of Christ, I would say in the life of Jesus. Like, what if there's a life we could look at and go, when you act that idea set out, what does it look like? And there was something there to learn from. All right. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say. Go live the questions, and we'll pick it up again.